Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Guest today is Rob Brink, former minister, who's going to answer our questions about whatever you want to ask a former minister. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you.
I had a question. I was going to talk to us about confirmation bias. How much of that, of recognizing confirmation bias, ended up leading you out of the ministry? Was it more the day-to-day work, or was it this whole sense of confirmation?
Oh, it was definitely both. Confirmation bias played a big role in it. The magic dragon was that was an important thought experiment for me. I realized, for example, let's just say prayer. The adorable little old lady that I love like my own mother, and she's got cancer, and she says, "Will you pray with me, or will you pray for me?" So what do I pray? Do I pray that she'll be healed? Because then, if she's not, is she disappointed? Does she feel betrayed? Or do I pray that God's will be done, because that conveniently covers all options? Right. So that was, I saw that in myself. I saw that I had already begun to hedge my bets. And I saw in Christian culture in general how both sides of the bet were already covered. You're making a break for the red light, and you say, "God, I'm late. I'm going to get fired. Please, please, I just need that light to turn green." And then it turns green, and you say, "Thank you." And except it doesn't turn green, and you say, "Wow, I must really have a lesson I need to learn here. I need to be more responsible." So it doesn't matter how the light turns. The answer is, God wanted it that way. And when I realized that I was playing dragon games, that was a very important step for me to recognize that in myself.
Why don't you give us some background, starting with your Bible college and what that was like?
Background is, I grew up in the church.
In the Congregational Church?
No, actually, it was an independent church, part of the Christian Churches, Churches of Christ movement, which is part of the Reformation movement, if you're into that. It was Restoration Movement. So not, it was
Campbellites.
Yeah, Campbellites, and it was this the middle of the road branch. You've got Disciples came out of that, and they're the more liberal branch. You got the Christian Churches that are more, let's call them evangelical, and then you've got the Churches of Christ Non-Instrumental, which are more fundamental conservative. And we were part of that middle group.
What does Unity Church fit in?
Unitarian? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's a completely different movement. I don't know enough about them to say.
So it's not connected to it.
Right.
It's kind of Eastern.
I don't know.
So
I grew up.
So that this is a historic, to answer, kind of a historical grouping where it ended up. These three branches.
Those three branches.
Together.
Yes. Yeah, they grew out of an American revival movement that sort of swept.
It was a restoration movement that attempted to restore the New Testament polity of the church.
Right. And that American root produced three branches. But three major branches, shall we say. So I grew up in that central branch, and my youth ministers it's probably hyperbolic to say they saved my life, but they definitely shaped my life. My parents went through a divorce, and they provided a safe space for me. And they were challenging and encouraging, They pushed and they pulled in all the right ways. They were amazing. And I knew I wanted to be that for somebody else. So, you know, I looked around my church at all of the people that I respected and admired, and they all had the same Bible college in common. So I knew if I wanted to be like them, I should go to the one thing that they went to. So I went to the same Bible college and had a great experience. It was at the time called Minnesota Bible College. It's now called Crossroads College. It's in Rochester, Minnesota. So I came back, did a very brief stint as the world's worst carpenter, and wound up accidentally in charge of a youth group at a congregational church. And then over a period of time, I went from being an evangelical who was currently serving a congregational church to a congregationalist. And then moved on from Beloit to Wauwatosa, and from Wauwatosa to Saugatuck. Saugatuck was my first solo pastorate. And in that time, moving progressively further and further left, was there for 5 years, and now I'm done.
And one of your positions was a youth minister?
Yeah, the first two were youth ministry. Beloit for 6 years and Wauwatosa for 3-ish.
How long ago was it that you stepped away?
Last year, it's been about a year.
So it's pretty recent.
Yeah.
Was it hard to work with the teenage kids?
No. All ministry is hard in that you're dealing with broken people walking through a broken world. So in that sense, it was hard. But I never really thought of teenagers as less than. That's part of why I was good at the job, was because I always just thought of them like people. And they treated me like people. Yeah.
The teenagers that I grew up with in the family tended to be very confrontational with the Sunday school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And argumentative.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I asked.
Well, I had some of those kids, and I actually really enjoyed those kids.
Because they were questioning.
Right. Mm-hmm. They cared enough to push back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Prior to today, had you ever spoken in a Unitarian congregation?
No.
So you never went that far to the left within the ministry?
No. I was a Congregationalist member of the National Association.
Of churches?
Yep.
Of course, you know what Garrison Keillor says about UCC. It stands for Unitarians Considering Christ.
Yes.
Yeah. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Have you, you know about the clergy project?
Yeah, that's how I wound up.
Oh,
yeah.
Can you describe that process?
Yeah, it was toward the tail end of my career, and I was actively considering doing something else. So I'm, you know, Google searching, you know, jobs after the ministry, which got me a whole lot of, Mormon links.
Oh, because their ministry is.
Yeah, because when they go, when they go on their missionary tour, then they come home and they're looking for a job. Right. Yeah.
Or many.
Right. So in that process of looking for options outside of ministry, looking for options after ministry, I stumbled on the Clergy Project, and. At the time, you know, the Clergy Plot Project is explicitly for atheists, and I was not there yet. So I didn't sign up, I didn't look further into it, but it was encouraging to me to know that there were other people out there who had made a life for themselves, you know. Yeah, clearly there are other people who have done this, you know, even if I can't be a part of their group, I can at least know that it is possible. So we left, and that year after we left, where we were living with family in Janesville, that was just really, really hard. And we, you know, through that through that process, when I was sort of free to think my own thoughts without worrying how my decision might impact the lives of an entire congregation, I got to the point where I could say I was agnostic, and then I got to the point where I could say, yeah, I don't believe this anymore.
That must have been terrible in terms of identity. You know, I'm assuming by that time your whole identity was so thoroughly into the ministry and into the Christian mainstream.
Yeah.
That it must have been a terribly difficult.
It was not a fun year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's when I joined the Clergy Project, and that was very helpful. They had a job placement service that they hooked me up with, so there was sort of light at the end of that tunnel, that there was a possibility of more work. And then there's this forum full of other people who are all going through the same thing and sort of commiserating with each other, saying, "Wow, this really is hard, but you know, trust us, you can get through it," kind of thing. So the Clergy Project was very important to me. And then through there, I wound up at Sunday Assembly, and through Sunday Assembly, I wound up here.
When did you first start attending the Sunday Assembly monthly meetings?
I don't know. Not too many months ago. Maybe...
early this year?
Maybe 3-4 months.
Oh.
I don't know.
No, I was just going to say, I grew up in a serious evangelical Christian family.
Mm-hmm.
And as I grew older, I really started to study the Bible. The more I studied, the less I believed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind
of... It was definitely part of the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. The, you know, every week, you, in my tradition, we have the lectionary,
right,
the calendar of readings. So, you know, I'd be handed these texts, and I'd say, okay, how is this going to speak to today? Like, where's the bridge between what was and what is? And it's your job to build that bridge. Well, occasionally, that's easy, and occasionally, it's really, really hard, because the text that you're working from, you know, might be misogynistic, or it might be racist, or it might be violent. And
incestuous.
Yeah, yeah, you know, there was just some... There were moments where I was sort of confronted with scriptures I didn't want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And learning, and then not just me trying very, very hard to find a way to interpret this that was both faithful and honest. Yeah, like that was hard. What was worse was listening to other people's sermons. Because what I recognize, and again, this was another dragon.
Enough detail that you.
This was another invisible dragon moment. Was I would work on a text and get to a point where I could feel like, okay, this is honest to the text and honest to the culture of the day and helpful for today, and I can speak it ethically. Like, okay, I worked really hard to get here. And then I turn on the radio and hear somebody else use the exact same text and just crush me, you know? And I looked at that and I realized that you could pretty much make a text say what you wanted it to say.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
And again, it's the dragon thing. Like, if a text can mean anything, well, then it doesn't mean anything.
Right. Oh, that's a great quote.
That's a fantastic
quote.
I remember reading Virginia Mellencamp when I was a feminist, trying to make, you know, contextually putting St. Paul in a box to try to make him work as a, she turned herself into a pencil trying to fix St. Paul, and he's just
unfixable.
He's just a misogynistic.
Well, if that was Paul. And that's one of the ways that some people get around it, is they say, well, that particular one was written by...
That's the other thing, when you get the experts, try, you know, the different strands in the Old Testament,
right,
and all of this stuff, and it's like, what?
Right.
The priestly text and the, you know,
yeah.
just, you know, it's... if it doesn't speak straight, I mean, if you have to dig that hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did an interesting exercise with the Sunday school class last semester. I was part of the curriculum, mm-hmm. where they had different quotes. And then they had biblical scholars. There were quotes from Jesus,
mm-hmm.
ostensibly. And then they had biblical scholars that had looked at them and said, well, this is consistent with our understanding of Jesus because of this. This isn't consistent because of this. And so we read them all out. We had the kids read them. And then we read what the biblical scholars had written.
Oh.
They enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But so a lot of these biblical scholars would say, no, there's no way, because he did not think of himself in this way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he was defending the poor, this probably wasn't, you know, based on things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I think those would be sort of the three pillars for me, was dealing with the text, dealing with real life, just the pain of carrying a congregation, and loving science and rationality, and being forced to confront myself and rethink what I think. I think those three things together were sort of my big turning points.
Did you ever have a person in the congregation who thought more traditionally that you had to confront your reality?
I have both ends of the spectrum. The congregational camp is very broad. It's a big umbrella. So we had folks within our congregation who were out in front of me, you know, who were essentially Unitarians who just went to church because their wife went, or because they liked the community, because there was no one else in town who was doing the good work that needed to be done.
Yeah, they're wonderful activists.
Right, you know, they, you know, and then I had other folks who were more traditional, who, you know, would occasionally want to have a more in-depth discussion about my interpretation of a particular text. And that responsibility, that's all part of being a pastor. You just have to, you have to meet people where they are and help them on their path.
Did you ever come out as an atheist to them?
I wasn't an atheist at that time. Mm-hmm. No, I worked very hard to be clear and to be ethical in the pulpit. I said if a lot. I wondered. Mm-hmm. I wondered aloud, like they were aware of my concerns. I tried to be clear about that. I tried to be honest about that while still being encouraging. And the place where I broke, the place where I knew I had to step down, was when I realized that the depth of my internal questioning was getting to the point where it was making it hard for me to be there for them. It was, you know, like if you can't bandage somebody else's arm when you're missing your own, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I got to a point where I needed to figure myself out before I could honestly stand as an example for somebody else, and so I stepped down.
Did your sermons towards the end get more and more liberal?
Probably. If I went back and looked, you know, from the time I started at Beloit to the time I ended, absolutely. And that would be very obvious if you looked at the sermons. From the time I started in Saugatuck to the time I ended, probably. There would probably be a difference. It wouldn't be a huge difference. I was definitely, by the end of Saugatuck, I was very firmly in the LGBT camp. And I was on the fence at the beginning, so that's an example of a shift that I walked with them.
So are you working now as a minister?
Nope. I got hired recently at an internet company down in Beloit, and I'm enjoying it very much.
You don't have to figure out which side you're on.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole lot of things that I enjoy about it. One is I get there and the lights are already on. I'm not responsible for everything. I'm responsible for my thing.
Right.
You don't have to make sure the fur is worse.
Right. Another enjoyable thing is there is a procedures manual, and for most things, a right and a wrong answer.
Yeah.
You know, I lived for 15 years in a world where it was very difficult to come down definitively on a right answer. Now, I could claim to have the right answer, but I had, in my opinion, too much intellectual honesty to do that. You know, my more conservative friends would say that I wasn't a faithful enough biblical scholar, you know, to do that. So it's nice to be... What?
I did not agree with your take on it.
Well, sometimes, yeah.
I was thinking another thing that I met, from talking to other ministers. I have a friend who said, she was a minister at a small town.
Yeah.
And she said, you're never not the minister.
Right.
You know, you're pumping your gas and you're still a minister.
Right.
And when people would ask you over to dinner,
yep,
it was what hidden agenda,
yeah,
do they have?
That's what Gilman, yep, was talking about.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my least favorite moment in meeting a new person, because I did a lot of my sermons I'd like write down at the bar, and I'd meet some new person and we'd be talking, and I actually really dreaded the moment when they asked, so what do you do, because I wasn't gonna lie, but I knew that up until that time they were fun and friendly and interesting, and otherwise I would go find, so I would just say, oh, I'm done today, and I would leave. But if I was sticking around, it was because I liked them. And then we get to that point in the conversation and they would change.
Yeah.
You know, and you could never predict how they would change. Maybe they would start explaining why they don't go to church anymore. Like, I'm not accusing you. Why are you defending yourself? You know, or maybe they would start criticizing me for being in a bar. Or maybe I would become the living embodiment of every piece of baggage that they carried from 8-year-old Sunday school, and suddenly the bar isn't a fun place to be anymore, you know?
You become judgmental.
Yeah.
Because you become a
role. Right. You take on a role. Yeah, so I don't miss that at all. I go in, I do my job, I check out, I leave. I don't think about it. It's done. It's really nice.
Asking your girls
what people picked up on. When you were still a minister, did your children go to the Sunday school at that church?
Yep.
And then after you left, what happened? Did they stop going to Sunday school?
No. We moved to Janesville, and they went to church once in a while when they felt like it. And then I came out to my wife about my concerns, and as a reaction against my doubt, she made sure that they started going to church, which is fine. You know, it was an important formative thing for me, and there's, you know, a whole lot of good to be pulled out of that tradition. It lasted for 2,000 years because there's good in it. If it were all bad, it would be gone already. So I'm completely comfortable, you know, having a conversation with my 14-year-old or 16-year-old or 18-year-old son someday, or daughter someday, where, you know, we have to talk about what dad really thinks. But for now, you know, they've got people who love them and who teach them to be nice to each other. I'm okay with that.
Do they go to the UCC church in Janesville?
No, it's a local church that has a good Sunday school.
Okay. Tell us about how you got invited to talk to the Janesville UCC Church.
Oh, the Janesville UCC, boy. This was while I was still a doubting believer. I started attending Janesville UCC. They were going through an interim search. I connected with the interim. The interim walked with me through this process. We became friends, and she walked me through this. And she knew her congregation well enough to know that that they would be okay with me preaching there. So she invited me to cover for her on a Sunday she was gone. And you know, paragraph one of my sermon was, I don't believe this anymore. And, you know, because I needed to be upfront with them. I needed to be honest. So, and they rolled with it, and there wasn't a problem. We did the sermon, and it was very well received. I had a few people ask if I would apply to be their new minister. And I had, a few people say, we definitely want you to come back. You know, we'll put you on the sub list, and we'll have you back. Well, I posted that online, and then I think Bob read it. Oh, you read it? Yeah, and wound up getting invited here, for which I'm very grateful.
Oh, yeah.
And today is her last day. So she sent me an email. Yep, she sent me an email this week saying, you know, see you, love you, miss you, kind of thing. Hope you have a great life. Today's my last day. And I said, I'm really sorry I won't be able to be there. I'm preaching at the UU in Madison because you invited me to share your pulpit. And she said, I couldn't be happier that you're not here. Yeah.
So when I went back to get that online sermon, I wasn't able to get into it again. So if I wanted to refer you to the Free Church in Sauk City, is there some way I could refer them to that service that they could read about?
Well, you guys made a recording of this one.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Send them to my website.
Okay, that's even easier.
And send me a link too, because I have friends who couldn't be here today who would love to hear it, please.
Okay. I'll get it posted on our website.
Thank you.
That expression that's part of the title is about, was that something you came up with yourself?
The what?
The expression that was the title of this book.
Well, confirmation. Yeah. Bias.
Bias confirmation.
Oh, the phrase confirmation bias? No, that's not me. That's psychology.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
I like the my side.
Yeah. No, that was very well done. I had to do children's sermons for years. I respect a professional. That was well done.
Now, what I love the image of the dragon. The dragon.
I was building the dragon.
I'm going
to
make him a little
vest
to wear.
You already made this invisible.
Okay.
That's right, it's done.
It's done.
I have been thinking about the fact that we all exist in this bubble of confirming our own biases. Mm-hmm. We're all very comfortable there.
Mm-hmm.
We have other, and I like here, you know, when everything has, when you don't have to go out and explain it, there's something wrong. Do you have other tips to things to look at in ourselves that help spread it? I think the fact that we talk to the same people all the time certainly helps us live in that little bubble.
Right. I think we, it's like I said at the last question I answered, I think this is the fundamental question of Western civilization. That, and I think we've been in that fight ever since, you know, we've begun the process of developing the scientific method, is that, you know, learning to let reality confront us and learning to live with the pain of that. That process of revelation, that process of reorganization, and learning to be okay with not knowing. Every new person we bring in, we have to carefully train them in that skill, because it's not a natural mode of thought. Like, we really have to work at it.
Is that part of letting go of time?
Yeah. Yeah, it's stepping into the unknown. It's admitting you don't know. If you accept that all we know are very small truths, then you go from knowing pretty much anything to knowing pretty much nothing. And that, accepting that that's true, is really, really scary. But then eventually you learn to be comfortable with it, and then it becomes kind of fun. Because someone asks you a question about GMOs, and instead of having the right answer already, you get to go, you know, I really don't know. I don't know enough about that yet. So let me look into it. What would you recommend? And then it becomes more fun.
I was thinking it's a lot of what we believe is who we trust.
Yeah.
That's true. Because we don't have direct.
Right.
There's so much, even in science, that we have no direct experience of our own.
Right.
So we have to take the word of those we trust.
Right.
So I can see,
right.
You know, like, I know the world is round because somebody
right.
told me, because I've seen pictures.
It's not empirically obvious.
That somebody said.
I see it right. That's pretty
well,
good.
Except
that's
I can't right. see the curve. I can't see the curve.
Yeah.
So maybe that wasn't such a great example, but it is an example of something we just, that people didn't accept,
right.
that we now accept. Well, there's a lot of things like that where the germ
right.
theory,
yeah.
the, you know, I mean, there's
oh,
all kinds
sure.
of stuff.
The age of the universe is like
the
that.
Age
yeah.
of the universe, right. We accept those because the people who we trust to have the answers
right.
say that's true. Well, if all the people we trust say that God created the world and
right.
did it in X number of years and created, you know, if those are the people that you've grown up with and you trust,
right.
it's sort of the same way that we trust science.
Right.
Because it's the people who you trust are saying this. So in some ways we say, well, you know, science says so-and-so. Well, who is science, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
but you can have a whole lot of different kinds of people.
Right, exactly. But
yeah.
you have a whole lot of ministers telling you that
yeah.
God is the,
mm-hmm.
you know, up there.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, so what I guess what I'm saying is we shouldn't say, oh, these people are stupid, or these
right.
people haven't thought about it, or this,
right.
you know, that process of what we believe is not self-evident.
Right, right. I think I would put this sermon, even though, and maybe this is a fault in the sermon, because the sermon sounds like it's sort of explaining everything, but actually it's a very small segment of knowledge that we're talking about. And if we held ourselves to that standard all the time, we really couldn't even get in the car. You know, we operate most of the time well outside that ball of confirmed knowledge, and most of the time we're operating under heuristics or rules of thumb, and the simplest one is, who do I trust? Which is why 90% of believers in a specific religion believe what their mommy and daddy believe.
Right.
You know, and that isn't insulting them. That's fundamental human reality. That's just
yeah.
how we work. If we didn't work that way, we wouldn't work at all.
Exactly.
You know, like you let's just suppose a million years ago, there was a little sub-branch of humanity that existed in a constant state of existential doubt, they would get nothing done and they would die.
Right.
Maybe they did and they didn't.
Yeah.
Right, maybe.
Maybe they used to exist.
Right, right.
What about a culture where the people don't know the answers, but they're waiting to figure it out?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what the Unitarian system does too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think most scientists would adopt that stance.
Yeah, I guess
And I think that's why I don't make an equivalency between a minister and a scientist, because the minister has the answer.
Even scientists, though, have bias.
Everyone does.
Well, I'm thinking of the tectonic plates when the guy came up with that theory. I mean, people literally ran him out of the field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he died totally not vindicated, and it was, what, 10 or 15 years later that they finally said, yeah,
Darwin wasn't exactly celebrated.
He was right. You know? And this was the early 20th century. I mean, this is not ancient.
Mm-hmm.
We're still gathering evidence on everything.
Right. And while that's certainly true at a micro level, at a human level, a personal level, that's absolutely true. If you look at it at a macro level, the strides that science has made from the birth of science to today, the progress science has made, the discoveries that it has produced, you compare that with the discoveries that have been made by Christianity over the same period of time. You know, it's, and to me, that looks like a no contest.
Well, and they did ultimately come around to the fact that the tectonic plates were there and moving.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there were some people that went to the grave never accepting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that science does move. It just doesn't necessarily move smoothly.
Or quickly.
Or at human scale. Yeah.
Well, it should though, because it needs time to be tested.
Yeah, well, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't just instantly
fall
onto the first theory that somebody comes up with.
That's a maybe change of mind. I was thinking about bloodletting.
Well,
at one time, it was the way to treat a patient for some things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got that through that, and that was horrible. And then suddenly they're talking about it again.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think medicine is, you know, alternative medicine is.
There's excess of iron in the blood that
is
indicated by the
issue. That's common.
Right, they have you actually give blood because you're...
Have there actually been studies on that?
Yeah,
but there is a condition.
There's a certain condition where...
Yeah, but not for everybody.
You produce too much
iron and you can get arthritic symptoms from it and stuff and the purest
blood.
So
in sunset.
Right.
Last Sunday's sermon, when we talked about my privilege and stuff, there's sort of a cultural confirmation bias too. It's like not white privilege is all about. There's this bias that most of the white people are not aware that they have.
Right.
I mean, it's not part of your everyday experience.
You can talk about it.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, we need to be jolted out of that one. We're treated different because of
that. And we have an expectation of each other.
Yeah, I guess we do. Yeah, I mean, if we were treated,
it's an assumption. I remember when, but I even know that. Which years ago she gave up. That was her, she gave a talk at Curry that was my introduction to white privilege. And one of the things she talked about was like going to the hardware store after you've been, you know, how if you're African American, you always need to be dressed to the nines to go out, and if you're white, you don't necessarily.
Yeah.
And I was telling that story to the grannies, who are incredibly aware, you know, older white women, and several of them said, you know, when I talked about going to the hardware store, if you've been working and you're in your groceries and you need something, you want to. You know what I mean? Think about it. I said, no, you never ever thought about
that. Yeah.
You know,
so many of the judges and rank as racist.
Yeah, right. And these are not, you know, incredibly biased. These are, you know. But it was like, yeah.
And to think about what Ken said about, you know, the lukewarmism is worse in many ways than just outright. You know, antagonism, that you know where you stand with the Ku Klux Klan, but the liberal that tells you, you know, it's time, you bide your time, your time will come.
Yes,
that's harder for, in a way, to deal with.
Right.
I'd like to talk a bit more about religious bias. We talked about, Christians talk about the Holy Bible, which in itself implies that there's something that shouldn't be questioned. And what were the things that you ran into as you ended your ministry where the unquestioning acceptance of parts of the Bible were a real problem?
I had come down on my side of that particular argument a long time ago, so it was less of a problem for me. I became more liberal in my views of Scripture and more liberal in my interpretation of Scripture, maybe back in seminary. So that experience gave me the flexibility to respond to whatever was going on, and it put me at odds with my more conservative brothers and sisters much earlier on. So I think because of that, I tend to be less aggressive about religion than a lot of my atheist friends are, because I've been fighting that particular fight for like a decade. You know, I was a congregational minister, and we were having arguments between the ministers about a conservative versus a liberal interpretation of Scripture. So that's like an old fight, and I'm used to it, and it doesn't really bother me. Where I have other friends who came directly out of, let's say, an evangelical or a fundamentalist mindset, and they're just, we need to take this down, you know, and I'm not there. I know too many decent human beings on both sides, all sides of those camps. I have too many friends on all sides of those camps. So even though it doesn't speak to me as holy anymore, it definitely speaks to me as ethical. And I still have great respect for Jesus.
Well, I have a brother who was a minister, a Methodist minister, and I exchanged an email with him a year or two ago about scholars who are questioning whether the biblical Jesus really existed.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to have gotten to the point where he thinks that what you read about what Jesus did and said was mostly made up by the early Christian church, and it was not a historical Jesus at all.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had other ministers who came to that point of view?
Yeah, I didn't know personally. I didn't have a friend who would make that claim. I know there are ministers out there who would, not a ton. But
why did they come up with this idea that it was somebody else's imagery in John? More than one person?
They were promoting it. More than one scholar. Yeah,
did they have a concept of more than one person becoming Jesus? I mean,
that
Jesus having come from
basically, they were promoting their religion, and they saw that other religions had virgin birth and things like this, and these stories were created around the figure of Jesus. There was one Jewish historian contemporary with when Jesus is supposed to live then. And Josephus, and he says, Jesus of Nazareth, son of Joseph. That's about all he said. And then there was another section where they talk about the words were put, they think it was pious fraud put in there after the historian was gone, saying Jesus was the Christ and this sort of thing.
Sort of the life of Brian. Well, and that's sort of what my Sunday school is working, what those biblical scholars are doing, are saying, you know, with the concept of a historical Jesus and what is consistent with the idea of a story. You know, you have the basic somebody who's out speaking to the poor and that sort of thing, versus the overlays of Christ on top of that. So that was very, the kids really liked it. It was very interesting.
The temptation in the desert kind of thing, that's like probably suspect.
There are biblical scholars who say, well, it doesn't really matter whether he lived or not because the ethical principles are there. And that's what counts.
Which I guess would be where I fall now. I wouldn't look at the Bible as divinely inspired. I would look at it as a surprisingly accurately preserved record of human moral development. Because if you look at, you know, the Old Testament, you can see shades of barbarism.
What the shades?
Yes. But then within that, or out of that, you can see that developing over time, you know, where you can see some pretty brutal stuff, and then you can see reinterpretations of brutality, and then you can see calls for less brutality, and then you can see the later prophets saying things like, you know, away with your songs and your worship services. I don't give a care about your church services. Go out and actually help people for a change. You know, so you can see this sort of progressive development, and then Jesus is clearly a step beyond that. And I think that I personally think that that's why the book still exists. I think it's an evolutionary document. It's a record of humans' moral evolution as we find an idea that works better than the last idea. And then we live with that for a couple hundred years, and then we find another idea that works better than that idea. We keep moving forward until we get to something pretty blissful, like the idea that at the center of reality is Trinity and Incarnation. That at the center of all the universe, at like sort of flowing out into all of existence, is this concept of community and oneness and a willingness to interpenetrate into someone else's life and become them and let them become you. And like that, okay, that's a beautiful idea. And I could see how that beautiful idea would change someone's life in a really positive way, that they would want to perpetuate that for the next generation.
Interpretation of the Trinity. Yes. Yeah. Whoops, there goes our Unitarian
party. Yeah. Wow, that's very, I've never heard that sound
before. Yeah.
Very interesting.
It sounds Eastern.
Yeah. The God who's known in community is a pretty modern.
So that would be my current, ask me again next month, that would be my current interpretation of Scripture, that it's a progressive record of our developing good ideas about how can we exist in reality and how can we treat each other.
Have you read the book of Judas? And I think there was another thing too that theoretically was found more recently.
Oh, the Gospel of Judas? Somebody bought me a copy. I haven't read it yet.
Do you think it's a creation of hoax?
I don't know.
Do you think it really was old?
I don't know. No, I would leave that question to scholars who are much better able to argue that question.
The people that you might trust.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, like the guy said, I mean, there's a difference between some guy who heard about it on Tuesday and someone who spent their life studying it.
Oh, okay.
I think that's worthy of respect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just love your interpretation.
The Trinity,
that's great.
Why don't you spend one more time for us?
Yeah. But maybe, you know, with Francis and everything, he's involving the papacy too.
Yeah, I love the new Pope. Oh, what a cool dude.
Still got a ways to go with women, but
he's working.
It's progress.
Yeah.
It's progress.
Leaping forward.
The two sort of centerpieces of Christian theology are Trinity and Incarnation. So Trinity says that at this...
All of which Unitarians reject. But I like your interpretation.
Okay, so I'd say maybe not the center of Christian belief. I could say the center of traditional Orthodox Christian belief. That they had two big ideas, and one was Trinity, the other was Incarnation. And the idea behind the Trinity is at the center of all things, there is a community that is one. And if you live that out, that looks like a church. That looks like a community. it looks like a family, you know, that when those things are operating at their very best, when they are truly unified, it feels divine. And to, you know, to say, wow, that's actually a reflection of some deeper thing, and we need to like want to be that and work at that. I think that's a powerful idea. That resonates through the world, I think. And then the other one was incarnation. You know, the idea that God was not content to scream at us from above, but that God stepped into our life and our situation and said, I am one with you so that you can be one with me. Well, then how does that relate into how we treat each other? To step into the other person's shoes and walk with them and invite them to walk with you. I can see how that would be transformative too. I can see why those ideas survived for 2,000 years.
Any other questions for Rob?
If not, he's going to be over next. Yes. Namaste.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.